Probably millions of women, as we speak, are stressed out by those unreasonable, irrational, culturally created expectations, and are living this very sacred, short, powerful thing called life in misery. Okay, worried about things that are not all that important in the big picture.
Welcome to the Enlightening Motherhood Community. Here you will find a non-judgmental community offering support to mothers raising children with extra challenges. This community was created for you to empower moms who love their children deeply, but are also overburdened, overwhelmed, or just plain stressed out. We are the place for moms who sometimes find themselves feeling at the end of their rope and are looking for hope and light. Join us as we help you enlighten motherhood. Hello, everyone. This is Emily, and I am thrilled to be able to air today's episode. I've been looking forward to it for weeks with great excitement. A little bit of backstory. When I was in college studying Spanish education, I had lessons on deep culture that have been life-changing, not only for me as a Spanish teacher, just for me as a human that I've carried on and used for me as a mom. They taught me to question my own paradigms and the lenses through which I'm not only viewing the world, but also viewing myself. And I think it was the start of me beginning to get my love of paradigm shifts. Anyways, I felt as though these same lessons would be of great use to many of our podcast listeners. So I reached out to the professor that gave me those lessons and asked if he would be willing to come on the show to give them to you directly. And of course, I was just ecstatic when he agreed. So without further ado, allow me to give a brief introduction and we'll jump right in. Dr. John J. Ivers, a former public school teacher, has worked as a university professor for over 36 years and has served as a department chair and college dean. Over the years, he has presented at over 32 academic conferences or educational organizations and has also authored 15 academic articles on teaching-related issues. John has also written a book called For Deep Thinkers Only, How Culture Manipulates Your Reality. He received his bachelor's and master's from Brigham Young University and his doctorate in education from the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. And I will add that on a personal note, he is an incredible teacher, department chair, and college dean. And that not only were his methodologies amazing and effective, but his obvious care for his students, his fellow teachers, and really all people is inspiring to me. And I'm grateful for his example and the positive influence that he has had on my life. So I'm so excited to have you on our show today.
Well, Emily, it's a great honor to talk to one of my favorite and finest ex-students. Yeah, you were one of my best ones. And I'm glad you're out there doing these amazing podcasts and making me look good. That's you're representing me very well. And I'm glad we're Facebook friends and able to keep up with each other, even though I only post maybe 3 things a year. But anyway, I'm honored to be here.
Well, thank you for coming. And so I've asked you to talk a little bit about deep culture. This is a lesson that you taught me multiple times when I was in college that has stuck with me throughout my life, even though I won't admit to how many years later it is since I took one of your classes.
Not very many years.
And you agreed to come on and talk. What do you mean? Like, what is meant by deep culture?
Well, to best explain deep culture, let me cover just a few basics first. There are 3 realms to our human existence. For example, the first realm is the universal realm. The universal realm are things that pretty much all human beings, no matter what culture they're members of, have in common. For example, almost every human being on the planet is scared of snakes. It doesn't matter what culture they're from, they're all scared of snakes. And no one knows exactly why that is. I mean, one of the going theories is that our ancestors that weren't scared of snakes were like selected out of the population, if you dig what I'm telling you, and so anyway, everybody has this fear of snakes deeply embedded within them. Almost every human being on the planet fears spiders. We all, pretty much every human being on the planet, fears social scrutiny. Yeah, we're all terrified about the neuron firings bouncing around in other people's heads, and no one knows exactly why that is. There are anthropological theories about that, but it's well known that pretty much everyone on the planet fears social scrutiny, especially negative social scrutiny. Generosity is admired in every single culture by pretty much every individual. And proficient use of language, which is interesting, proficient use of language is admired universally as well. And then the second realm of our existence is the cultural realm, which we're going to be talking about today. And then the third realm of our human existence is the individual realm. Everyone has a genetic code unique in the entire universe. Yeah, we're all unique in the entire universe. Based on our genetic code, and there will always be individual differences. Studies have shown that about 20% of all people follow their cultural mandates almost all of the time. 20%. 60% of all people follow their cultural expectations most of the time. And the remaining 20% almost never conform to their cultural mandates. I mean, we all know some of them, right? Okay, that is one of the reasons that stereotyping doesn't work, because we're all different, unique individuals. Now, returning to your first question about deep culture revolves around the influence of what are called paradigms. That's PARADIGMS, paradigms. Paradigms are models of reality that we use to interpret the world. And the word interpret is key in all this. Interpretation is an essential word when you're talking about deep culture. There are many simple paradigms, millions of them, of simple paradigms, like what is a bird, what is a car, what is a cloud, et cetera. And most people on the planet will agree what they are, but they are still used to interpret the world. For example, it's said that some of the early Spanish explorers of the New World, when they encountered buffalo, they called them cows because they were vacas. They more closely resembled cows than anything with which the Spanish were familiar with. It's reported that when some Native Americans first encountered horses, they called them big deer. We use paradigms we possess to give meaning to things. Most people in the world would agree concerning what is a bird, what is a car, what is a cloud. However, there are more complex paradigms that can differ immensely from culture to culture, such as what is arrogance? What is too prideful? What's not prideful enough? That sort of thing. What is humility exactly? When can you be too humble? What is spirituality? What is a spiritual person? What is physical modesty? What is an attractive man? What is an attractive woman? What is a valuable person? Those are more complex paradigms. And many of the aspects of these particular things are taught to us by the particular paradigms of our particular cultures. For example, concerning spirituality, let me just pull one out of the hat there, spirituality. There are many cultures in the world where one's personal spirituality is interpreted by strong vocal and physical enthusiasm. That's the way you show you're a spiritual person. Okay, I'll be kind of loud in your worshiping. Whereas there are other cultures, such as most of the religions in the United States, where one's spirituality is demonstrated by showing quiet reverence. Therefore, the people coming from cultures where spirituality is expressed strongly and vocally might misinterpret the being quiet and reverent crowd as not being very interested in spiritual matters. Whereas the quiet and reverent crowd will definitely misinterpret the loud crowd as not being very spiritual at all. And due to extreme differences in deep culture, deep cultural paradigms out there in the world, people are always interpreting others incorrectly. And this is a very, very big and they are also interpreting themselves incorrectly, often to the detriment of their self-images as moms, dads, spouses, general human beings. Yeah, interesting stuff.
That is fascinating. What might some specific examples of how our culture's paradigms could negatively affect us?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, cultural paradigms can actually kill us. Yeah, they can actually kill us. However, let's start with something not quite as extreme as that. Let's talk about self-esteem. Let's talk about self-esteem. That's a good one to talk about first. You know, paradigms are so powerful that our self-esteems are at least partially cultural bound. There are some experts out there who think they're completely cultural bound, okay? But at least partially culture bound. Culture is so powerful that two people with identical characteristics, if there ever would be such a thing, two people with identical characteristics growing up in two different cultures may end up with dramatically different levels of self-esteem. You know, William Shakespeare said, and I think it's in his work, As You Like It, I'm not 100% sure about that, but William Shakespeare said, "Oh, how bitter a thing it is to look into happiness through another man's eyes. Oh, how bitter a thing it is to look into happiness through another man's eyes." But, you know, that's what we do all the time. Okay, we look into our personal happiness through other people's eyes, the people that have created the paradigms that inform our realities. And you know, Socrates said, "The unexamined life is not worth living." Okay, the unexamined life is not worth living. So sometimes I think we need to examine ourselves and examine our cultural paradigms. Now, culture provides you, very nicely provides all of us, with an ought self, the way you ought to be, okay? How a good person ought to comport himself or herself. And I would say 90% of this culturally created ought self is good. It is very, very good. And it helps us be better people and helps society to function and keep society together. About 90% of it, probably. And then there's the real self. The real self is the way you really are. Your personality, the talents you happen to have or don't have, your physical characteristics, all kinds of things, the way you really are, okay? And see, when the real self is close to the ought self, then the higher your self-esteem will be, according to the research. But when the ought self and the real self are further separated, there's some distance between them, then according to the research, the lower your self-esteem will tend to be. However, some of the culturally created ought self is irrational, it's absurd, is dangerous, is damaging, okay? And it's extremely important that we examine the paradigm, I'll talk about some of those things later on, but it's extremely important that we examine the paradigms upon which our self-interpretation is based. Our self-concepts tend to be fragile things. For example, some statistics. One out of every three Americans has a self-concept dominated by the negative, one out of every three. That means that one out of every three people listening today feels more negative things about himself or herself than positive things, one out of every three. And if that weren't bad enough, It takes, on average, 14 positive experiences to make up for the self-esteem damage inflicted by one similar negative experience. 14 to 1. For now, some research says it's 16 to 1. A recent piece of research said it was 12 to 1. Let's go with 14 to 1 because kind of in the middle there. It takes 14 positive experiences to make up for the self-esteem damage inflicted by one similar negative experience. For example, if after this podcast today, let's say I'm reviewing some of the comments about the podcast, and if I see one comment saying, "Don't ever invite that Ivers guy again. Man, I wasted an entire hour of my life listening to that guy. Man, I'm like 1 hour closer to death right now, and that hour is wasted. You know, he was I just don't ever invite him again." I'm going to have to read 14 comments saying, "Man, I digged everything that Ivers guy said, man. I want you to have him a whole lot of time. Man, I was on a high during the whole presentation. I haven't felt this way since the 60s, baby." See, I'm going to have to hear 14 of them before my self-esteem is restored to the level it was when I heard, when it was restored to the level it was before I heard the negative comment. That is how fragile we are. Now, you asked for some specific examples how paradigms can negatively affect us. Let me talk about a few historical examples and then talk about a modern-day issue or two or three or whatever. But anyway, let's go back in the fairly recent past. In 1930, there were some Australian gold miners in New Guinea camped out on a mountain ridge. And below them was a valley known as the Grand Valley of New Guinea. And it was assumed that no human beings could live there. The land was considered uninhabited and uninhabitable because the forests were so dense, they didn't think anyone could hack through the underbrush and everything to live there. And so, camped on a mountain ridge at dusk, they watched as the receding daylight revealed a multitude of points of light, obviously coming from campfires in the huge valley below. It was the first glimpse of a civilization unknown up to 1930. First glimpse of a civilization untouched by the modern world, a civilization that had developed in isolation for 1,000 years, a civilization of 50,000 people living in the Stone Age, unaware that any other humans walked the earth. In his book, The Third Chimpanzee, geographer Jared Diamond, who also, by the way, got a Pulitzer Prize for writing Guns, Germs, and Steel, mentions that an expedition finally entered the valley in 1938. And when they walked in to the village, the main village, okay, it was a huge shock experienced by both parties. It was a collision of two worlds, a collision, you know, that was exacerbated not only by extreme technological differences, but by major differences in the way they looked upon sexual things, physical modesty issues, assumptions of the very nature of the world. Jared Diamond says there wasn't a single individual in the Grand Valley of New Guinea born at least 5 or 6 years previous to that first contact who does not remember exactly where he or she was at that surreal time when the walls of their reality came tumbling down. Let's look at the evening before the first contact. You know, that evening before the first contact was likely no different than any other evening throughout the valley's 7,000 years of human habitation. No different than any other evening during those 7,000 years. And during that final evening, the very last evening when their culture still exercised its strong grip on everybody, life continued on as usual. Continued on with culturally created pride, culturally created pleasure, culturally created pain. And let's just speculate for a minute. Maybe there was a young man sitting outside his hut, staring at the fire with a heavy heart because a holy man had publicly declared that he was unclean and he was making other people unclean by things that we would never consider at all unusual today. And the holy man's diagnosis was clearly confirmed to the young man when he accidentally stepped over a young child, making the child unclean. So the holy man had to be right, according to his culture. You know, maybe that evening, there was a young girl as she fed her family's pigs. Maybe she was trying to hold back her tears as other girls snickered at her three-fingered hand, as two fingers necessarily, in quotation marks, of course, necessarily had to be sacrificed to her father's ghost. These are just things I've discovered through researching these people in New Guinea, that particular group of people. Maybe that evening, a grown man cringed inwardly as he wondered if people would find out if he had been negligent in placating his deceased ancestors, a sin that no doubt thought about his brother's untimely death and likely offended mountain gods. Maybe that evening, a grown woman preparing her earth oven to cook a meal stared into it with the look of inferiority, because she was purchased with a lower bride price, and it was widely known that she once accidentally spoke the name of her mother-in-law, something that was absolutely forbidden and be a stigma on you the rest of your life. 7,000 years, 7,000 years, one evening after another, this culturally created pain hovered over that valley and influenced people's self-images. But you know, all that is not unique to the Grand Valley people. The Grand Valley people, they're called the Dani, D-A-N-I, the Dani people. It's everybody, it's every culture, it's everywhere, it's us, it's us. We have culturally created pain, and sometimes it's just as irrational. But let me give you another historical example. I think it'll even be cooler, okay?
All right.
Of how deep culture can dramatically affect people's lives and self-image. Another example might be the ancient Olmecs. Ancient Olmecs. You know, the ancient Olmecs lived in southern Mexico, and they lived kind of in the skinny part of Mexico, down what's called the Isthmus of Tehuantepec, kind of toward the southern end of Mexico. And they were a great ancient civilization, the first major civilization in ancient Mexico. But you know what? They were unknown and forgotten until about 120 years ago. They were unknown and forgotten, the forgotten lost civilization that was huge when they existed. And they weren't discovered until someone was hacking through the jungle and ran into this huge stone face. This huge stone face, about, you know, maybe eight or nine feet tall, that was carved out of this huge rock. And that was the first hint that there was a lost civilization there. And archaeologists have dug up quite a bit now. One interesting thing about the Olmec culture, and one of the big things the Olmecs are known for, is what's called the were-jaguar look. You know, like a werewolf. They had, you know, a werewolf is part man, part wolf. Okay. Well, anyway, they have what archaeologists have called the were-jaguar look. Okay. And by the way, the word Olmec is an Aztec word. We have no idea what those guys called themselves. Okay. But anyway, the jaguar was a very important god in ancient Mexico and ancient Central America, even up into Aztec times, 3,000 years later. The Olmecs lived from about 1200 BC to about 300 BC. Give or take a few hundred years, you know, those days change all the time, you know. But anyway, there are many figurines and representations and motifs in the Olmec world, the archaeologists have discovered, which portray an individual, always a man, whose head is deformed so that he looks like a jaguar. For example, what they would do is when the man was a baby, they would deform the head so the top of the head, okay, was skinnier than the bottom of the head, kind of like a jaguar's head. Another thing they would do is they would cut off his upper lip, cut off his upper lip so his teeth were always exposed. So it looked like he was growling like a jaguar does. Okay? And they would file down the incisor teeth as well. Something that's hard for you and me to think about. And motifs of that kind are all over the place, but yet there's a lot of representations of quote unquote normal people too. A lot of statues of normal people and pictures of normal people on the walls and that sort of thing. And so we don't know exactly what was going on there. Okay, there's enough of those were-jaguar looking people that it's assumed by many archaeologists that it was that people they did surgery on people and they practiced head deformation. And maybe those who got the head deformation and cut off their upper lip and all that sort of thing, maybe they had good self-esteem because they resembled jaguars. Maybe they were the wealthy people, the prominent people. Maybe those who didn't have the surgery had low self-esteem. If they were a male, and maybe they received zero attention from the females if they didn't have the deformed head and that sort of thing. And were the ones with head and face deformation, were they smug in their superiority? And were the normal people always feeling inferior and insecure? But then again, maybe there was no surgery, and maybe there was no head deformation. Maybe these people were babies that were born with spina bifida or Down syndrome. Because some of the representation that they have, the representations seem to strongly resemble babies with spina bifida and Down syndrome. And maybe, just maybe, these are all theoretical because a lot we don't know about the Olmecs. Maybe when a child was born with Down syndrome or spina bifida, maybe the family celebrated. Maybe the family celebrated. That meant there were jaguar genes in the family, god genes in the family. And in, or maybe, just maybe too, that all these representations are completely mythological and no one ever got deformed, or no one was ever, no real person was ever considered a were-jaguar. You just never know. Anyway, one interesting thing too is that there are carved motifs, carvings, statuettes, all over the Olmec world of a were-jaguar baby in the arms of an adult male. They're all over the place. A were-jaguar baby in the arms of an adult male. It must have been one of the most poignant, one of the most powerful stories in ancient Mexico for over 1,000 years. And we don't know what it was. We don't know what it was. But returning to the babies with spina bifida or Down syndrome, if that theory is correct, it's the perfect example of the overwhelming power of culture. It says that in some cultures, if you're born with spina bifida or Down syndrome, in some cultures, you could be the object of shame and pity, maybe. And in some other cultures, you could be a god. You could be a god. The power of culture can never be understated. And maybe it's time for a more modern day example, more modern day example. And I think this is compelling here. According to one study, 80% of the men in the world prefer women who are slimmer than the American very slim ideal. 80% of the men in the world prefer women who are not as skinny as the typical American ideal.
So, sorry, I wanted to clarify that. So, 80% of the men in the world prefer a woman that.
Is heavier than the typical American skinny ideal that you see today.
Interesting.
In fact, if you look like the typical American woman today and you lived in many parts of Africa, they would send you to the doctor and they would do everything they could to get some weight on you, or you would never get married because none of the men would be interested in you. Until you became the type of woman that would be considered too heavy today by American cultural standards. You know, all this stuff about weight is very, very interesting. Okay, what is the perfect weight, okay, for a man or for a woman? And of course, you know, women worry a lot more about that than men do. But anyway, what is the perfect weight for a man or a woman is almost completely culturally determined. Yeah. Studies have shown that you're only unattractive in all cultures if you appear anorexic. Okay. If you appear to be anorexic. Okay. And that means you have like a real sunken face, you know, and obviously you have an anorexic look about you. You can be extremely skinny, but if you don't look anorexic, you're fine. Okay. But if you look extreme, look, if you are look obviously anorexic, or if you are extremely obese, like we're talking about 400 or 500 pounds, okay, then you'd be unattractive in all cultures, but any or time periods, but anything between those two extremes, okay, you would be considered attractive in some culture or some time period. A study was done on women's perceptions of their bodies in both Spain and Mexico. And all of the women interviewed were of similar ages, height, and weight. However, the girls in Spain all wanted thinner hips and legs. And the girls in Mexico all wanted bigger hips and legs. Okay. Even though physically they were all basically the same. Okay. And of course, there are many things about attractiveness that are biological rather than cultural. But most of those biological things are noticed subconsciously rather than consciously. However, there's enough cultural stuff that probably everyone in your listening audience, I'm going to make quite a statement here. But anyway, it's only interesting if I make dramatic statements, and people might be dozing off right now. So I'm going to make a dramatic statement. I hereby do predict that everyone in your listening audience would be a sex symbol at some point in the cultural space-time continuum. Okay, most of us just find ourselves at the wrong point. Yeah. Anyway, but interesting stuff.
Yeah. That is fascinating. You mentioned earlier that culture can kill us. What exactly did you mean by that?
Well, it has to do with shame and embarrassment, and which is culturally caused. See, much of shame and embarrassment is culturally created, and we need to always ask ourselves, is this shame and embarrassment I'm feeling right now culturally created shame, or should I legitimately feel shame? You know, in ancient Rome, one of the people that is universally admired in ancient Rome, he was a contemporary of Julius Caesar. His name was Cato the Younger, C-A-T-O, Cato the Younger. And the famous Roman biographer Plutarch said of him that he would intentionally dress out of fashion. He would intentionally dress out of fashion to, quote, accustom himself to be ashamed of only what deserves shame, and to despise all other sorts of disgrace, unquote, or something like that. In other words, he would intentionally dress out of fashion so that he could get used to not worrying about culturally created shame and only worry about things that really constant, that really should bring upon real shame. Now, I first learned about this when I was speaking at a conference on educational matters in Dublin, Ireland. And, I presented at 30 something conferences, you know, and before the person who presents before you, you always kind of hope, maybe selfishly, hope that that person won't blow the audience away. Because if that person blows the audience away, then the expectations for you are gonna be higher. You know, it's always best to go into a talk with low expectations, you know, and then you do a lot better, okay, with that. And so what I did is I attended, you know, the lecture right before mine, okay, and the guy right before me, his name was Mario Martinez, just blew everybody away. But let me tell you, it was worth it. It was worth it because he changed my life. My presentation probably didn't appear as good, but it was worth it. He changed my life. And you know how he changed my life? He talked about how basically the feelings of shame, also embarrassment does it too, stress does it as well, fear will do it and that sort of thing, guilt will do it, but shame is the big one. Whenever human beings feel the emotion of shame, okay, their body releases pro-inflammatory elements into the bloodstream. Yeah, their body releases pro-inflammatory elements into the bloodstream. And basically, one of the reasons, see, shame is a very strong emotion. And so as human beings, we evolve to prepare ourselves physiologically for woundings, okay? When we are in a situation of great stress. If you look throughout human history, people were under much, much more stress than they are today, much more danger than they are today. You know, if you throw a spear into a mammoth, the mammoth gets ticked, you know, just living everyday life was very, very dangerous. And so our bodies evolved to release pro-inflammatory elements whenever we were under situations of great stress. And these pro-inflammatory elements, they basically cause swelling and they cause blood clotting so that if you're wounded, you won't bleed to death, okay? And so nowadays, in this day and age, when life is a lot safer, okay, our bodies still release those pro-inflammatory elements when we're in situations of great stress, okay? And when there is no wound to address, then these pro-inflammatory elements end up causing plaque buildup in our arteries and veins. And according to Mario Martinez, in a personal conversation I had with him after his presentation, people who experience a lot of shame in their lives have a very, very high chance of dying of heart attacks and strokes in their 60s. Yeah. Yeah. People who experience a lot of shame in their lives have a very high possibility of dying of heart attacks and strokes in their 60s, according to his research. Okay. Now, of course, when I was being raised, shaming you was probably the way to go. You know, my parents would shame me all the time, you know, and I experienced a lot of shame. And I'm now I'm 65 years old. And so, I'm starting to feel a little woozy right now. Anyway, and so, you know, I hope I wasn't shamed too much, but anyway, you know, we should ask ourselves these questions. Should we really be embarrassed when we feel embarrassed? Should we really feel shame when we feel shame? In whose interest is it that we feel this way? A lot of times we need to ask ourselves this. In whose interest is it that we feel this way? It could be a particular individual's interest. It could be the broader society's interest, business interests, who knows? In whose interest is it that we feel this way? You know, and we have to try our best to let go, but it's very, very hard. The great educational psychologist, William W. Perkey, says we all cling to our culturally generated self-concept like a drowning man clings to a straw. That's what he said. We all cling to our culturally generated self-concept like a drowning man clings to a straw. And maybe we ought to just let it go, man, and just float, you know, and we need to examine some of these things. Now, there's a lot of, I'm sure a lot of your listening audience are wondering about examples of culturally created shame. I'll just throw just a few out. There's probably countless thousands of them. Shame, of course, is one of those cultural universals, those human universals we talked about at the beginning of the podcast. Shame exists in all cultures. It's something that everybody experiences. And I think everyone will agree it's a horrible, horrible feeling. Basically, everyone on the planet has experienced it and everyone tries to avoid it. And to escape that dreadful feeling, we often need to navigate specific culturally created obstacles, which can be unique in every culture. But the world is replete with shame-inducing circumstances in one culture that would cause no shame at all in another. For example, we just talked about weight. It would cause no shame at all in another, okay? Yeah. As you know, Emily, being an expert on Hispanic culture, in Hispanic culture, if someone is overweight, a male or a female, their good friends will give them a nickname, a gordo or gorda, okay, which means fatty. And they don't care. They don't care because their cultural paradigms inform them that their physical appearance should not be a source of shame to them. Whereas, unfortunately, here in North America, our cultural paradigms inform us somewhat differently. Okay? But anyway, some shame-inducing examples from different cultures and time periods might be in many parts of the Middle East and South Asia. If a married woman talks to a man, just has a simple conversation with a man she does not know, that'll cause her great shame, and it might cause her much more serious repercussions. Just answering a question from a man she does not know. Another incident, another situation, in most of the world, not in the United States, but most of the rest of the world, probably most of Asia, for example, and most of Africa, a good chunk of Latin America. A student receiving high public praise when the rest of his or her peer group does not could cause that student a lot of shame. Whereas here in the United States, we kind of dig every minute of it, man. This is great. I enjoy it. Our culture basically gives us a culturally created hunger for recognition. But some cultures have a culturally created dread of recognition. Another interesting thing, if a professor in many parts of Asia were to admit to his or her students that they don't know an answer to a question related to his or her field, that would be a source of shame for the professor. Whereas, as I'm teaching, students ask me questions all the time and I have to go, good question. I have no idea. And I'm wondering, in every one of my classes, I have an Asian student or two. And I'm wondering if the Asian students are thinking, poor Dr. Ivers, poor Dr. Ivers. You know, he's just been humiliated in front of the whole class. But doesn't seem to be humiliated. He's laughing and joking as usual, and they're probably perplexed, you know. Interesting, you know, in Native American culture, during the days of European colonization, in most of the Indian tribes, an Indian man would have been shamed if he were participating in the cultivation of crops. Real men did not farm. That was woman's work. Yeah, real men hunted and women farmed and gathered. And so one of the difficulties that the Native American tribes had in adjusting, okay, to the North American way of life was it was complete opposite in the European view. The European view was real men did farm, okay? And the better farmer you were, the more impressive man you were, okay? And so they had a very difficult time acculturating, assimilating into that, okay? And that brought about a lot of tragedies. And another interesting thing, in ancient Hawaii, pre-1819, when the Captain Cook arrived in 1819, in ancient Hawaii, If you were seen eating in view of the opposite sex, you were shamed. Yeah. If any member of the opposite sex saw you eating, you were shamed. And according to some accounts, it's kind of blurry at this point because it was before the Europeans arrived. We have only accounts of people who understood it, Europeans who may not have understood it completely. And in some accounts, it was kind of a sexual turn on if you saw the opposite sex eat. And some men would try to look into women's huts so they could see a woman eat. And one of the kings of one of the Hawaiian islands declared the death penalty for any man who did that because they were humiliating the females on the islands. Now imagine, just imagine if we were to bring back one of those males, one of those, go back in time to maybe 1818, and bring him into the present with a time machine and take him to like Outback Steakhouse. What would be his reaction? What would be his interpretation? So his cultural paradigms would force him into the interpretation that Outback Steakhouse is like Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, an evil, promiscuous place. Now, another interesting thing, things today, in some cultures, if you are sitting in a classroom, you're a student, you accidentally put your feet on the book rack of the desk in front of you, and the teacher notices it, that could be a source of shame. Whereas students in the United States do that all the time. If you're seen wearing shorts by the opposite sex in some places in the world, that is causes shame. And fashion, of course, fashion creates tons of culturally created artificial shame all the time, not being in fashion. Materialism creates a lot of shame. Lack of certain possessions, driving old cars like I do, living in a small house like I do. But I don't care, man. I grew up in the hippie generation, babies. That's fine, you know. But anyway, but yeah, it's but see, those, of course, I'm informed though by the 60s paradigms, you know, which caused me to not worry so much about that. But anyway, there are tons and tons of culturally created issues that cause culturally created shame. And I guess the bottom line is we all wear culturally generated scarlet letters. We all wear culturally generated scarlet letters, but it's up to us on how we let them affect us. Yeah, interesting stuff.
That is all such good messages. As you know, the majority of the listeners of this podcast happen to be mothers. And just my mind has so many ideas already. And I've heard this lesson a few times from you, but even again, I'm just thinking of all of the applications I could have. But do you have any final message that you could think that would help mothers who feel as though they're struggling or maybe their children are struggling?
Realize that a part of your reality is artificially created and should not be uncritically accepted. For example, let's look at the idea of the ideal woman in many parts of the United States. The expectations for the ideal woman are completely irrational, completely irrational. But yet, you know, probably millions of women, as we speak, are stressed out by those unreasonable, irrational, culturally created expectations and are living this very sacred, short, powerful thing called life in misery. Okay, worried about things that are not all that important in the big picture. Okay. And as far as their interpretation of their children, okay, and maybe their interpretations of their children and their children's behavior may be influenced somewhat by irrational cultural paradigms, and those things need to be examined as well. I think taking another lesson from the 60s is that we always need to be cool, man. We always be cool. Yeah. You know, a lot of times, things tend to work out really well on their own anyway. It doesn't mean that you don't do your best to make good things happen, but usually everything works out okay. And the majority of children, despite our concerns and our worries about them, they turn out to be good, productive citizens. But sometimes we create our own demons by looking at the world to paraphrase Shakespeare through other men's eyes. And we don't follow Socrates when he said the unexamined life is not worth living. Yeah. And if any of you are interested in learning more about this, I wrote a book. I wrote a book, and it's called For Deep Thinkers Only, How Culture Manipulates Your Reality. And you can get it, just go online to barnesandnoble.com. Amazon has two or three copies, I think, but most tons of copies on barnesandnoble.com. You don't have to join up or anything like that. And
I'll link it in the
show.
Sorry, I'll make sure to put links in the show notes. So any listeners can just click on that link and order your book.
That'd be great. I talk a lot about stuff like this and a lot about cultural rationality and all kinds of interesting things. And I also bring out that there are some interesting studies out there that indicate that exposure to cultural diversity by children may enhance their intelligence. And so might be interesting reading for the moms out there. Yeah. And cultural diversity doesn't have to be foreign cultures. You know, it can just be an hour drive to another place, you know? Yeah.
That is such valuable information. Thank you for sharing that today. Do you have any final thoughts before we end for this episode?
No, just like I said before, thanks for being one of my finest students.
I just imagine you had many fine students, but I will take the compliment. Thank you.
You were really special. And thanks by your great example, for making me look good out there, by your incredible example. I appreciate that very much. I need all the help I can get, so I appreciate that.
Well, thank you again for joining us today.
It's been an honor. You take care, Emily.
Thank you. You too.
I'll see ya.
Okay, what an amazing episode with so much food for thought. If you can think of someone that would enjoy or benefit from this information, I'm sure they would love it if you would text them a link. And if you would like more information on the services I offer as a life coach, please be sure to visit enlighteningmotherhood.com for more information. Thank you so much for joining us today. Until next time.